We're going ghost hunting tonight with John Kachuba. We're going to be creeping through haunted asylums, abandoned farmhouses, historic battlefields, and all kinds of places looking for ghosts. John's next on Coast to Coast AM. John Kachuba, he's an author, paranormal investigator, of course, and his new book is Ghost Hunters, On the Trail of Mediums, Dowsers, Spirit Seekers, and Other Investigators of the Paranormal. He is one of the best. He's a certified ghost hunter. He has investigated more than 80 haunted locations in the last 3 years. He is a frequent guest on radio and television programs and also is a noted speaker at paranormal conferences. He has written other books unrelated to the paranormal and high strangeness and teaches creative writing at Ohio University. He lives in Athens, Ohio, and that happens to be one of America's most haunted towns as well, John Kachuba. Hey, John, welcome to Coast to Coast.
Hi, George. How you doing?
I'm doing great. It's our pleasure to have you on the program tonight.
Thank you.
How haunted is Athens, Ohio?
Athens is very haunted. The British Psychical Research Society, sometime back in the late 19th century, called the Athens area one of the most haunted locations in the world. They said that this is an area where several ley lines apparently come in and converge, and so they say there's a lot of energy in the area. The Shawnee Indians, who were here sort of in the 19th and 18th century, considered the Athens area itself a sacred place, a place of energy, and would never hunt there or anything else, but would just kind of reserve it as sort of a special power kind of place. In the late 19th century, the spiritualist movement, when that was big, set up a tabernacle on a mountain in Athens called Mount Nebo. And this was a very famous center that was in existence for about 40 or 50 years before it was struck by lightning and burned to the ground.
How fitting, huh?
Yes, exactly, right? But yeah, so there's a lot of activity, and even today there's a lot of ghost stories associated with the area, one of which, you know, I have a chapter in my new book, Ghost Hunters, particularly about the Athens Mental Asylum and some of the things that have been going on there. So yeah, it's a very interesting place.
How did you get interested in all of this?
Well, you know, I grew up in Connecticut, and that's a place where you couldn't walk 50 yards without stumbling upon some old colonial cemetery and the stories attached to that. And I've always been a big student of history. And when you learn history, you tend to learn a lot of these other, you know, stories about, you know, hauntings and that kind of thing as well. But probably what triggered it more than anything was while I was living in Connecticut, at one point I lived in the same town as Lorraine Warren and her husband Ed, the late
Yes.
Ed Warren, who passed away last year.
Wonderful guy, too.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I got the chance to meet them, you know, personally, probably 20 or so years ago when Ed was still hale and hearty and long before his stroke or anything else like that. And they kind of got me interested in it a little bit, too. I was actually going up to Dudleytown in Connecticut for a whole different reason, actually for sort of a historical research for some fiction that I was working on, and it turned out becoming a paranormal investigation more than anything. And I talked to the Warrens about some of the photos I had taken up there and what looked like anomalies on there, and they were very helpful and just sort of got me interested in the whole field from that point.
I've been interested in this for a long time. I've never been a ghost investigator, John. Really never went on any specific ghost hunting trips. I was at the haunted Queen Mary last year. That's a strange place. You ever been there?
You know, the funny thing is, I had been on the Queen Mary and long before I knew it was haunted. So I wasn't particularly looking for anything, but just walking through there thinking, it has kind of a creepy feeling to it. But I'd like to go back now and actually do an investigation there.
We're going to digest Ghost Hunters tonight and go through some of these incredible stories. And then maybe later on when we open up the phone lines, I'd like people to share some of their ghost stories with you, and maybe you can shed some light. You know, some people are so skeptical about ghosts. They don't believe they exist. They think they're created in everybody's mind, a figment of their imagination. What do you tell people like that, John, who say, this is a bunch of bunk?
Well, you know, George, years ago, I probably would have said the same thing. The more I got involved in trying to learn about this with an open mind, which is the first thing, to try to be open to things, The more and more I started hearing stories that seemed very credible, and then started having experiences myself that made me think, well, something is going on here. I mean, there's always going to be skeptics. There's always going to be diehards who you'll never convince of anything, you know. But I really think if people just started looking at this a little bit more, and they are, by the way, I think more and more people are beginning to look into the paranormal, I think they'll find out that there is something going on. And, you know, it may be something that 50, 100 years from now, we may actually find science that will explain some of the things that we are today calling paranormal. In other words, they may actually have some physical law or something that we don't understand yet. Quantum physics has so many different theories to it that seem to indicate that ghosts may actually exist, or something that we call ghosts. So I just tell people, you know, you've really got to be open. You know, if you're closed to anything, you're going to be closed to this as well.
You know, what I love about this program, we bring in so many guests who have their own perspective, and some people will say we're dealing with pure demonic forces. Other people will say it's all angelic. Other people will say there's a balance. I mean, we get, or extraterrestrials that aren't too happy with mankind. You get all kinds of things here. Have you finally gotten to a point where you can tell yourself what this might be, this entire phenomenon?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned all those different viewpoints, because in my new book, in Ghost Hunters, I do have people in there that do represent different viewpoints about what the nature of ghosts are, what the nature of the whole, you know, paranormal phenomenon might be. I'm not sure that I'm reaching any conclusion as to what it is. I'm reading more and more these days, as I said a little bit earlier, on quantum physics and things like that, and beginning to think that there might just be more to the idea of sort of parallel universes or alternate realities. I mean, there's different explanations, there's different titles given to sort of the same phenomena. And we might just be from time to time bumping up against this, literally other worlds that we, for whatever reason, interconnect with or you know, collide with. And perhaps in that moment when that happens, we get this ghostly phenomena. It may be something along those lines. But boy, you know, I'm not a physicist. I mean, when you start reading some of this quantum physics and string theory and everything else, it just starts making your head spin. So I'm not, but it sounds plausible. And I might be leaning more towards that than anything else these days.
Is there a great argument and difference between those who are spiritual and those who are scientific? Because I think one day, like you said, science may explain this, but those who are extremely spiritual may simply say there is no science behind it at all. It's all faith-based.
Right, right. And that's a good question. Again, in Ghost Hunters, I have a chapter, for instance, about the spiritualist with a capital S, you know, members of the spiritualist church. And for them, this is part of their religion. This is a faith-based belief, you know, that when people die, or as they say, you know, pass over, they go into what the spiritualists call Summerland. And, you know, for spiritualists, ADC, as they call it, after-death communication, is part and parcel of their whole religious belief. And I think if you suddenly said to those folks, well, you know what, there's actually some physical phenomena going here. It's a matter of a physics principle that we haven't yet, you know, I think they're simply going to rebel against that. And, you know, religion always bumps up to science, doesn't it? I mean, there's always, you know, it's done that for centuries.
All the time. I mean, I get people, and we'll probably get some of these stories, who believe that they were saved by angels. And then I'll get people who believe that they were saved by demons.
Yes, right.
Who wins?
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, and you know, I mean, my whole viewpoint in all my books, in Ghost Hunters, as well as my first two paranormal books, Ghost Hunting Ohio and Ghost Hunting Illinois, my whole approach for all three books has been objective, and it's been open. And I certainly don't cast stones at anybody that has a religious persuasion behind their beliefs, or somebody else's scientific persuasion. I simply say, well, anything is possible, because look, we just don't know. I mean, you know, any theory I think is valid until one of them is proven and the others have to fall by the wayside.
What's more haunted, a state, Ohio or Illinois?
Oh, wow. Well, in both of them.
And by the way, if you're a Michigan football fan, one would think it's Ohio because somebody has put some heck of a curse on that football team.
Yes, that's true. I would say, you know, in each one of those books, I wrote about 36 places in Illinois, and again about 36 in Ohio. I have to say, I lived in Ohio for probably about 16, 17 years, and I am continually getting stories from people, you know, emailing me or calling me up about, do you know about this place in Ohio? Do you know about this place? So just on my experience right now, although Illinois sure has its share of ghosts, it seems like Ohio has even more.
Yeah, that's true. And I would guess the East Coast has a lot, too.
Well, yeah, and I think, again, that goes towards, you know, history when you consider that, you know, talking about the English being there in the early 1600s and the Spanish in Florida and, you know, 1500s around St. Augustine and whatever. So when you have a longer history like that, I think you're more apt to develop stories. But also, that's where the population center is pretty much, and that's where ghosts are going, you know. I mean, it's sort of a numbers game in a way. If you have a lot of people, you have a lot of ghosts.
You're also called the ghost hunter. What are you trying to accomplish when you go hunting?
Well, you know, my whole goal, as I said earlier, is not to either, you know, debunk something and say that everybody who believes in ghosts is foolish, or on the other hand, to be a rabid ghost supporter and say you've got to believe in ghosts. My whole purpose really is probably more educational than anything else. You mentioned I do teach at Ohio University, so I guess I'm, you know, at heart still an instructor or teacher. And I'm trying to just open the doors for people to get a look at what this whole paranormal phenomena is about, and to hopefully encourage them to get involved, to explore it more. In Ghost Hunters, I mean, I cover a lot of different sort of aspects of the paranormal. It's not just ghost investigations, but, you know, there's interviews with paranormal celebrities. There's stories about taking ghost tours, becoming a certified ghost hunter, you know, selling haunted items on eBay, buying haunted houses, all that kind of thing. And the reason is because that's all happening. It's all part of sort of our American pop culture in a way. And I think that if people take a serious attitude toward it, you know, they're going to learn a lot more. And I think they should take a serious attitude. If ghosts truly do exist, if they really exist, then
why do you say if?
Well, because I mean, you know, I'm married to a scientist who keeps me on the straight and narrow in terms of saying you can't say ghosts exist because there's no proof. So I have to say if until it's proven. I probably lean more toward the fact that they do, but, you know, again, it hasn't been proven 100%.
Okay, so you're not saying if because you don't think so.
No, actually, like I said, I'm open, but I'm leaning more and more, you know, especially over the last few years, towards the existence that there is something happening. There is something that we call, you know, ghosts, and there are things that we call ghostly phenomena that are occurring. There's no question in my mind they're occurring. What they are, what the nature of them is another question. And that's part of what, you know, these different people in my book talk about, sort of their ideas about what the nature is. But let's just say ghosts do exist, point blank. That changes everything that we know about reality, doesn't it? I mean, it just stands everything on its head. Suddenly that means, yes, we actually do go on. After we die, after we're dead and buried, something else happens. It's, you know, proven beyond a doubt, if that it can be proven. And so, to me, it's like, why wouldn't everybody be interested in knowing about the afterlife or the paranormal or ghosts? Because it affects all of us, or may affect all of us.
It should. You popped in a few people of notoriety in your book who have had ghostly episodes in their lives. Tell me about them.
In terms of, well, I mean, some of them, for instance, Marianne Winkowski is a person who I mentioned. I have a chapter with her. And Marianne Winkowski is actually the real ghost whisperer. There is that TV program, Ghost Whisperer.
Yep.
And it's based on her experiences. And in fact, Marianne is a consultant to the program.
Yep.
And here's a person, you know, who at the age of 3 years old developed or suddenly discovered that she had the ability to see dead people as the
She's been on the program as simply Mary Ann, our show. Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to stop you. Well, and I mean, you know, her name is out there, and she's said, go ahead and find. But you're right. That's how she's been known in the Cleveland area where she's from, is, you know, Mary Ann for the longest time. And so here's somebody, you know, who's had these experiences from the age of three where she can see these people, see these, you know, ghosts, and communicate with them, which is, you know, quite amazing. And live with this all her life. Actually, when I interviewed her too, I said, "How do you do that? I mean, how does one live surrounded in a sense by ghosts? Because she'll go everywhere and say, well, yeah, I see them every place." And she said, "You know, it's very difficult, obviously, but for her, unless she makes eye contact with that ghost, and the ghost makes eye contact with her and recognizes the fact that she can see them, if she doesn't do that." It's fine. They just kind of glide by, and she glides by, and there's nothing, you know, nothing happens. But as soon as that connection is made, she said it's terrible because they just pester her because they want something, whatever that something may be, you know, to talk to somebody still among the living, to pass on some advice, to solve a problem, all the things that you see on a television show. And she said it's crazy because they'll just follow me around and bother me and pester me until I do my work.
It could be her personality too, John, because she's very friendly. I mean, she's open to these apparitions and these spirits, and I think they cling to her.
Well, they might. I mean, you're right. She's a very warm, very generous, and open person, and I think that's right. And I think this is something for anybody interested in the paranormal, you know, again, to go into it with an open mind, because I think that if there's any kind of sort of affinity, let's say, for spirits to attract themselves to some people among the living, I think the ones they're going to go to are the ones who are very open about it and respectful and say, okay, I'm here. I don't know what this is about, but I'm willing to listen, or I'm willing to find out. And I think you'll draw things to you if you sort of take that approach.
If you had to poll people, John, and ask them, what do you want to happen to you? Do you want a very frightening, ghostly experience, or do you want something with a glorious moment? Mm-hmm. What do you think most people would say?
Well, my experience in talking to probably close to 300 people for these three books has been more the glorious experience or whatever. Most of them talk about experiences they've had that either have to do with family members who have died, or just some kind of a moment when they experience something that they don't find terrorizing. They certainly find it startling because they're not expecting it, but they find it very interesting, intriguing, you know, and they sort of stop and say, wow, what was that about? That was amazing. Did you see what just happened? And, you know, rather than running out of the room screaming, more often than not, the people I've talked to are sort of now convinced that, hey, I've got to find out what this is about. You know, they start getting more involved in it. I mean, I've had some people talk to me about, you know, being attacked and things like that. And so those things are out there. But far and away, in my experience, it's been quite the opposite. They've been sort of welcome experiences, awe-inspiring experiences, and sometimes very warm and comforting experiences, especially in the case of family members.
Is that because of the individual in question, the person who's alive? If they lead a pretty good life, they're friendly, they're loving people, do they tend to have these better experiences?
Well, that might be. My feeling is that, you know, with the kind of person you are on this plane, you know, if you're a lousy, rotten, mean person here on Earth, well, wherever you go later on, you're probably still going to be a mean, rotten, lousy person. And so, for me, that's sort of the negative energies that might be out there when people talk about, you know, contacting something that was frightening or physically abusive or something else like that. I don't necessarily buy the angel-demon argument. That's just not my personal belief. But I do think there are negative energies out there created by people who are negative.
That's true. Let's talk about that, John, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, thank you for helping LB. Like, you know, these one of the greatest, the Philadelphia Experiment. If you subscribe to the After Dark newsletter or renew, we'll send you a free CD and Art Bell interview with Al Bielek on the Philadelphia Experiment. But a part of the proceeds will go to Al Bielek to help him out of his financial situation. And that's a good thing, you helping out. So call 1-888-727-5505. You can also go online at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Our special guest tonight, John Kachupa. And John, let's talk a little bit about some of the things that you have found in your career looking at this field that probably for you might have been the strangest of anything. Is there one story there you can relate with us?
Well, personally, yeah. There's a couple of things. As I mentioned a little bit earlier, things have started to happen just in the last couple of years as I've been doing these investigations. And I think part of it, again, is because I'm going in with kind of an open approach and, no preconceived ideas. But I was in Florida not too long ago in Brooksville at a place called the May Stringer House. And I was doing an investigation in there with three other people who were sort of docents, I guess. The house is open to the public, and they were kind of like the caretakers or the staff. And we were walking through. We spent pretty much, most of the evening there in this house, an old Victorian mansion. We went dark, as they say. We didn't use any lights or anything else, and we just kind of quietly went around the house and just sat and tried to make contact with whatever might be in there. And the house was just preternaturally quiet. I mean, there was no sound or anything. It was just very, very quiet. And so after several hours, we were just saying, well, I guess nothing's going to happen tonight. As we started to lock up the house, do a security check, and to make sure everything was turned off, we started walking out the back door through an old kitchen that has all antique kitchen utensils.
Right.
And I passed by a wood-burning stove. There was three of us at this point. One had left earlier. We're walking in single file, probably within 2 feet of each other. And I'm in the lead, and when I passed this wood-burning stove, there was like a long metal hook that was just laying across the surface of the stove. And this thing just, the minute I walked by it, it just literally flipped up, on one over end, and just slammed itself down across the stove. And we all jumped. This thing, it just totally happened all by itself. And I said, "Did you see that?" Typical reaction, as I said. And everybody else said, "Yeah, we definitely saw it. They had the lights on it." We went back and we looked at this thing, and we tried to figure any other way that we can get it to move. And there wasn't anything that we can do. It just literally jumped up by itself and did that. And I have no explanation for that. Again, this is one of those things that I look at the laws of physics and say, well, that could not possibly have happened. And yet, it happened right there. I also was, in Florida, in St. Francis Inn in St. Augustine. I was in a room which is called Miss Lily's Room. And Miss Lily is the ghost of a Civil War era black woman who worked there in the kitchen and the inn and all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
And had an affair with the white nephew of the owner. And was sent away, as they say, and no one really knows what that meant or it means. Did they actually just send her away, or did they kill her or something? Nobody knows. But she's been seen in this hotel many times. And I was in her room for two nights, again, totally uneventful, very quiet. In the morning that I'm checking out, I'm sitting there at 10 o'clock in the morning, just throwing things in a suitcase, bright sunny day, no radio on, no TV, no sound. And all of a sudden, I hear whispering, a male voice, male whispering, like right in my ear. And it was kind of a very frantic kind of whispering, although I could not make out the words. And I jumped, as one would probably do, and turned around. And, of course, there was nobody there. I checked later on to find out sort of more of the story about the hauntings of this place. And a desk clerk who had been at this hotel for about 20 years told me that what they experience in the hotel, more often than not, is hearing people whispering. And I said, well, that's exactly what happened to me when I was, when I was checking out. So these are two things. I mean, they seem small by themselves, but yet, I'm hearing something now, and I saw something, that actually happened to me personally. But now I can look at these things and say, I can't explain those. There's nothing that I know rationally or logically or scientifically that explains those two incidents. And they happened literally within a few months of each other.
And it's not like someone's got a hidden tape recorder somewhere or anything like that.
Right, right. I mean, there's, yes, exactly. Especially like in the first place, the May Stringer house, there's only three of us, you know, we're just walking through this house. There was no setup of any kind. And the inn, I was there by myself, practically the only guest in the whole inn. I was there at the off season, you know. So, yeah, there wasn't any kind of setup or situation that, you know, somebody was trying to con me or something else. These things just happened. And that's what I said earlier. Once you have something like that happen to you, you start thinking, okay, I've got to check this out. I have to find out more about this field. I have to try to understand what's happening or what could be happening.
Does it become an obsession?
Well, it does for some people. It certainly does. I wouldn't say that I'm obsessed by it just yet, but I find it extremely interesting, and I'm out here, you know, spending, you know what, I guess I am obsessed. Now I think about it, spending all my time checking it out.
Yes, you are. I wanted you to admit it yourself, John. I didn't want to have to say you were.
No entrapment there. I guess I walked into it, though. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, and that's what happens. It does become very interesting. As I said, the questions that are behind this, if you start really thinking about, you know, what the realities could be, it's mind-boggling. So it's hard to shake it.
Have you noticed the incredible interest of buying things from haunted areas, going for incredible amounts of money, either on eBay or private sales?
Right, yes. I do have a chapter in my book about buying haunted items on eBay. And, you know, this whole thing was spurred by, it was a few years back, you probably remember the story of a woman who was selling, I think it was her father's or uncle's cane, walking cane, because her son was bothered by it. He kept saying it was haunted by, I think it was his grandfather. And so she put it up on eBay to sell it, and I think it was something like $120,000 or something. It was bought by a casino. And since that time, the floodgates on eBay have opened, you know, opened wide. And I have a whole chapter about that item, including the woman who was selling two poltergeists in a shopping bag. And she was selling them on auction. And she said that, these are her words, she said that she would make sure they were carefully wrapped in paper and put in a shopping bag. And when they're shipped, you know, they'd be wrapped so that they would not have a bumpy landing, as she said, when they arrived in the doorstep, I guess, of their new owner. And I spoke to her and asked her, you know, what was the bid on that? And she said, well, the opening bid was a penny. And I said, okay, and the closing bid? A penny. So she didn't make much progress on that sale. And in fact, she didn't sell them to the new owner because she said that she called that person and was not at all convinced that that person truly knew how to care for poltergeists. And so she thought she would just hold on to them.
The exorcism of the little boy that the movie was based on, of course, using Linda Blair as the girl. They changed it.
Right.
But the exorcism took place in St. Louis, where I am now, at the Election Brother Hospital. And I was told after the exorcism, they boarded up the room, they took out the furniture, and in some cases either sold it or gave it away, and that those people who had picked it up had very strange and bizarre occurrences as well.
Well, you know, there is something to this. I mean, I'm making sort of light of the woman selling the two poltergeists in the shopping bag. But at the same time, there is a lot to be said for the idea of objects, especially personal objects. And in this case, you know, something related to this boy and his exorcism. You know, personal jewelry, especially things that have a significance, like wedding bands, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. You know, often you hear that something happens to people that pick up those items, that there might be, you know, the spirit of the original owner or whatever still attached to something that had such a strong sentimental or emotional value. You'll often hear people talk about buying antique furniture, you know, going into a store and buying some beautiful old bureau or something, and as soon as they bring it in the house, all kinds of things happen, you know, and they get rid of it, and next thing you know, things are back to normal. So I don't know. I mean, I think there's a possibility if spirits can sort of attach themselves to the physical plane in terms of being in their location, you know, maybe they can truly sort of attach themselves to physical items. I mean, I don't know, but I think there's a possibility that those kinds of things can maintain that energy, you know, hold that energy of that person and, you know, maybe have some effects like that.
John, why the craze right now with ghosts and ghost hunting? And I mean, a lot of people who do not have the experience, they want to be ghost hunters. And then the television shows and everything else. It's huge right now. Why?
It is, George. And I think, you know, this is my personal belief. I'm not a psychologist or a sociologist, but I think that when times are bad or when things are sort of in a negative
tense.
State.
Or tense.
Yeah, exactly. When that's probably even better. When people are under sort of you know, emotional or psychological strain by maybe the world situation, and I think, you know, if you look at the popularity, as you mentioned, of all these TV shows and everything else, you're talking probably the last maybe 5 to 6 years, which has been kind of a tense time for us in America in a lot of ways. And I think that when people feel that there's that kind of stress imposed upon them, that they turn to something else, you know, for support, for comfort, maybe even just for simple diversion. A lot of people turn to religion, you know. I don't know, maybe you go gambling a lot. You just had that for Las Vegas. Maybe people spend their money and do that kind of thing. But I also think that the idea of the paranormal is something else. It offers people, in a sense, some hope that, you know, maybe there is something better. Maybe there is another life afterwards. It has its religion, and it has its parallel, I think, in religion when people hope to go on to some greater reward. And so no matter what happens here, you take comfort in the fact that, well, you know, I'll get my reward later on. So I think the ghost phenomenon might have something to do with that. And then after that, it just becomes kind of a fun thing. And the more people do it, for whatever reason, the more they tell their friends and bring other people into it, and so it just grows. But you're exactly right. I mean, the whole paranormal industry is a cottage industry today. I mean, I'm certainly not the only person writing ghost books, you know. I mean, there's a lot of us. There's a lot of people doing, as you said, TV programs. I mean, we're on a radio show right now talking about this to, you know, I don't know how many millions of people are listening. And so it's certainly a phenomenon. There's ghost groups in every state. I mean, there's hundreds of these ghost groups. They're ghost hunters or just sort of ghost enthusiasts, whatever you want to say, but there's hundreds of those. There's ghost conferences. Every town, I don't care how small it is, you know, has a ghost walking tour someplace. You can have 20 people in town, and there's a ghost walking tour.
Exactly.
Know? So it's amazing. And, I mean, I think it's a good thing, though. I really do. I think again, it's encouraging people to think about this and to get involved in some way, even if it's something as simple as getting on a motorized, you know, coach tour or something, you know, or air conditioning and just driving around town and somebody pointing out haunted locations. I mean, I think that's a start, and I think it's good for people to try it out.
Well, see, and I think all this is tied together, human consciousness, intuitiveness, the ability, I think, the remote view, ghosts. I think all of it has to do with the same kind of energy force that's out there, not only in this universe, but maybe the multiverses.
Well, I think you're right, and I think there's a consciousness right now, not just in ghosts, but, you know, in sort of all the things that people used to just kind of say was New Age stuff, you know, but there is. There's an idea of looking into the mind and how it works and other ways of thinking, other types of realities, other types of consciousness. And it's all tied together. You're exactly right.
Are there any religions that do not believe in ghosts, do not believe in the spirit world?
You know, I'm not certain about that. It seems to me that as I've been looking at this, almost every religion has some belief in spirits. You know, again, whether they fit the strict definition of, let's say, somebody who lived here and died and now is trapped between worlds or however you want to refer to it, or whether they're simply spirits, I think most do. But it's hard to say because I know that I have talked to, I don't know how many people who identify themselves as Christian, and yet the people who identify themselves as Christian seem to be split 50-50 on the subject of ghosts. Some of them will say to me, well, you know, the Bible says that, you know, ghosts are the work of the devil. They're demons. They're the work of Satan. And so we should have nothing to do with them. And, you know, I don't even believe they exist because of that. And other people will say, well, I'm a Christian, and I believe in an afterlife, and I believe in angels and spirits, and so, yes, of course, I believe in ghosts. So, you know, you get exactly a split right down the middle of Christianity. So it's really hard to say where religions play into these things.
If you believe in ghosts, must you also then believe in demons, the devil, evil?
I don't think so. I think, again, this is sort of your spiritual bent versus kind of your religious bent. For me, as I said earlier, I just think that I'm tending to believe that there's something that happens beyond the grave, that somehow our energy, you know, goes on in a different form, and that could be what we're calling ghosts. But I think if you're a negative person, you remain a negative person. If you're a good person, positive person, you remain a positive person. But that's not the same thing as an angel, not the same thing as a devil. They're just, you know, good and bad people. But for people who have a strong religious bent to them, then yes, there are demons and devils and there are angels, although they don't really fit the classification of ghosts because, for the most part, when we talk about ghosts, we talk about something that was alive and is no longer alive. It's in another realm. Whereas angels and demons, for the most part, I think most people will say, well, they've always been, you know, that they never had a corporeal existence. They never were in body. They were always spirit. They were always, you know, entities other than human. So in that classification, they wouldn't ever be ghosts. They would simply be whatever they are, angels, devils, however you want to refer to them.
John, where do you get this book?
Ghost Hunters is available everywhere. It's in bookstores all across the country, and it's certainly available online with Amazon.com and pretty much all the other online booksellers.
Okay, so you teach creative writing at Ohio University.
That's correct.
What do the students say about you as the ghost hunter?
Well, I think it actually improves my image because so many of them are into watching you know, TV ghost hunting shows and everything else. I think they think that I'm kind of you know, one of them in some regards. There's a photo in Ghost Hunters of a car I own, which is a 1987 Buick Skyhawk, and it's called the Ghost Hunter Mobile. And it's painted all over with ghosts and tombstones and things like that. And it was done by art students at Ohio University, so it is truly an art car. And, you know, that's around town a lot, and students recognize it, and they recognize me pretty easily, and, you know, I think they think it's pretty interesting.
Well, at least you're not driving around in a hearse.
That's right. That's right. Although if I get my hands on one, I might.
So what do you do on Halloween?
Well, Halloween is pretty incredible. Actually, living in Athens, Ohio, Halloween is a big thing there. They have a street party that is an informal thing that over the last 20 years has gotten to where they expect anywhere from 20 to 25,000 people come to Athens on Halloween night just to party in the streets, which are all blocked off. So it becomes, it's like Mardi Gras. So it's huge in Athens. It's a good place to be for me.
Hey, John, when we come back, let's talk more about this, obviously, but I want to talk and get your take on EVP sounds and get your take on what you think they might be and why we are able to record them. We're going to talk about some of the ghost tours he's been on and some of the visitations, again, through a haunted asylum and abandoned farmhouses and much more. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.